This is not a test. As Texas responds to a pandemic, health officials struggle to find ways to deal with a lag in coronavirus testing. The latest today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. In major cities across the Lone Star State, streets, schools, universities, office buildings getting empty. Events from rodeos to concerts and sports events all canceled or in the process of. So what comes next? We'll talk with the top official of the most populous county in Texas, Judge Lena Hidalgo, plus the politics of quarantine and a whole lot more as we continue to track the big stories of this day. The Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, well, you know our top story. It's Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Let's get to it. If you've been to the supermarket, you've likely seen lots of empty shelves. Some retailers, including San Antonio-based HEB, now putting limits on purchases of some items, including toilet paper, disinfectants, and water. Officials statewide continue to urge social distancing and hand washing as the best ways to combat spread of the coronavirus in Texas. As the streets of many metro areas have been clearing out with school and office closures, we are going to turn now to the top official in the most populous county of the Lone Star State. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo has been meeting with healthcare experts. Judge Hidalgo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we know at this time, school's been canceled. Many people are telecommuting. Major sports events, the rodeo, all of these have been canceled or postponed. Could you give us any insight on how closely connected the decision-making process has been here? Are these institutions making decisions on their own, or is there some kind of centralized decision-making process here?
It's both. You know, the community's really been a partner right now in tackling the spread of the virus, but we're also working at the government level in close coordination. Yesterday, Houston, Harris County, Fort Bend County, and Montgomery, we all gathered at Harris County's Office of Emergency Management and announced regional guidelines that basically ask gatherings of over 250 people not to take place. They say any gathering where you'll have folks in close contact shouldn't happen. Guidance for nursing homes, for employers to maximize telecommuting, and just asking folks who are at high risk of being severely impacted by the disease to stay home.
What is the latest that you have heard from health officials there in Houston about confirmed cases of COVID-19 or the coronavirus?
So I'm over Harris County, which is Houston and 33 other cities plus unincorporated areas.
Huge
so
area.
We have 17 cases in our region. So right now we've got 6 cases in unincorporated Harris County, 3 cases in the city of Houston, 6 cases in Fort Bend County, 2 cases in Montgomery County. And this, the bigger message, though, is we all, and my assessment has been, this is more than likely an undercount. And so that's really what led to these decisions. The rodeo, and we made that decision very quickly because we wanted to make sure that the concerts that evening weren't happening. Mm-hmm. But these broader guidelines were in the works, and they were announced just the day after the rodeo because we were recognizing that our testing capabilities are limited, that our epidemiological capabilities are limited. So we can't contain this by simply identifying everyone who has it and keeping them quarantined. We just don't have those resources, particularly on the testing side. And so we have to use a blunter instrument, a hammer as opposed to a scalpel, if we want to prevent a spike in cases, which with a population like ours would overwhelm the hospital system and therefore the community. So it's a hit to our economy. It's very, very tough. But the hit to the economy and just the community as a whole would be catastrophic if only, you know, 20% of 30% of folks in this community ended up needing hospital care
right
for the disease.
Does that mean that the concern that there aren't enough tests available, that that's now going sort of by the wayside? Now we're talking about what can we do as opposed to what we can't do at this juncture?
Not necessarily. So the concern about the lack of testing has led to where we are right now, because we can't have that very narrow guidance. That said, what we're doing right now is basically buying time so that we can develop that testing capability. We're just sharing, I'm coming from a meeting with the CEOs of all the major hospitals here in the medical center, and we're working together to develop the testing capacities. Ideally, we want to get to a place where we have anyone who thinks they're sick, that they are evaluated, that folks who need to be tested are tested, and that way we can move forward and isolate those people and therefore again stem the sharp rise of the disease.
Who does need to be tested at this point? I mean, is there a line that officials are drawing? You say, okay, we're going to, given the limitations here, we're going to test those who fit this particular profile, and we're not going to be able to test others.
So, one thing we've learned is that folks who are not symptomatic do not come back positive oftentimes, even if they do have the virus. And so there's a very real concern about testing people who just think they may be sick but don't necessarily have the symptoms. What we need to do on the one hand is test the folks who are symptomatic, do that triage, make sure that they're self-isolating. And that's why it's so important for us to be able to do mass evaluation and eventually testing for the right folks, which right now, because of the obstacles, we can't. And so that's why we've turned to, in addition to developing those tests, we've turned to these requests for the community to help us minimize exposure to one another and help that spike, keep that spike from happening in the cases.
Are you getting all the support you need from the state?
My bigger beef is with the federal government. We've not received the test kits that we need. There's a one case, for example, we had recently a young woman who just came back from Italy and she was diagnosed, but we didn't know if it was going to be that or if it was going to be strep throat. She has a history of strep throat, so we didn't want to alarm people, certainly the flight. We had to wait 4 days for her test to just be approved by the state agency for us to review. And those are all federal requirements. And we had a good conversation with the governor yesterday where he said if there is any red tape he can remove, he will do that. For us, of course, it's going to turn to a question of funding. These tests that we're developing aren't free. The materials aren't free. If we don't have the testing capabilities, we will see a spike and we will be overwhelmed. And so we'll be turning to all partners, including the state, for financial support.
What is the bottleneck when it comes to testing? Not enough tests, nobody to pay for it, not a source for the tests. What's that bottleneck?
There's some texture to that. So, until very recently, the CDC was saying that only people who traveled to such and such country and have symptoms should be tested. And so, if you go by that measure, you could argue there are enough tests for folks who fall under that category. Now, the reality of it is that we know that a lot of people had gone unidentified, people who had the virus. And so, there are folks in the community who have unexplained symptoms, not diagnosed with the flu, not diagnosed with strep throat, not diagnosed with anything else, could be coronavirus. And it wasn't until a couple of days ago, if not yesterday, that finally the guidelines changed to where we're saying, okay, they qualify too. And that's really what I think we should have had all along, what other countries have had. And so in my mind, in my definition, we've never had enough tests to go and make sure that we are evaluating all of those folks. And we also have a process that is difficult, which is we got to wait for state approval. Then, in our case, the test either gets assigned to the Houston lab or the Atlanta lab, and they only do certain runs every day. The private hospitals are doing some tests on their own. If folks go to the hospital, they're being able to keep up with the patients that go there. But you think Harris County, we're 20% uninsured.
So what are you now saying is the best thing for an individual citizen to do? If they're worried, do they go to a hospital and ask for a test? Or do they wait until they are symptomatic? Or what is the best suggestion, recommendation from the Harris County judge?
The recommendation continues to be the same. If you are feeling sick, first of all, do not participate in your daily activities. Stay home as a favor to everyone, because if you go, you are sure to put at risk the populations that can be very, very much harmed by this disease. And then call your doctor. We have lines. We have one. The city has one. Other counties have one. We're trying to get the state to help us do a statewide 211 for this, where folks can call if they don't have a doctor, if they're undocumented, if they don't have insurance. Mm-hmm. And anyway, you get a hold of the doctor and describe the symptoms and follow their advice. And probably they're going to say, you know, if they identify you with symptoms that are unexplained, they have their processes to get you to testing, whether through them or through our health departments. But it does us no good to test people too early, and certainly does us no good to have folks show up at the hospital, at the waiting room, and get other people sick. And this is really, we're trying to get ahead. Other states, other countries, they haven't gotten to this, for example, 250 person level, or you were saying any gathering really should be postponed if you can do it, where you'll have close contact, because we don't want to be like other communities that start at 10,000, then 5,000, then 1,000, mm-hmm. and by then it's too far gone.
Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, she's the head of the governing body for the most populous county in all of the Lone Star State. Judge Hidalgo, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Well, she's filling in a lot of the blanks there. Joining us now in the Texas Standard Studios, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Coronavirus concerns have prompted runs on stores for several household items like cleaning supplies, toiletries, and more. Now, some stores like Kroger and HEB have put limits on product purchases in place.
Yeah.
In a press release, San Antonio-based grocer writes, HEB has been preparing for coronavirus for several months, and we are in a strong position to keep replenishing our shelves. Via Twitter, we're seeing some of the reaction to those scenes. S.E. Robinson Jr. tells us at the HEB in Port Arthur, Texas, I saw a stalker come out with a pallet of paper towels and was engulfed by shoppers. The pallet emptied in 60 seconds.
Good Lord.
Interesting comment here via Facebook from Adam Kyle, speaking to the sort of psychology behind this. He calls it panic buying. He says people are scared and don't know what to do, so they buy stuff. It gives them a sense that they are involved in their own survival. So obviously people... you know, raising some concerns that the people that need to get the items they need can get them, but no concerns so far on a broader picture supply-wise.
And I think that's the real thing. Yeah. As part of the tweet from HEB, they say, customers shouldn't panic. We continue to restock shelves. We encourage preparedness, not stockpiling. Buy what you need and leave some for your neighbor behind you. That's a good rule, don't you think? Tweet us and let us know how it's going in your neck of Texas, at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Hey, it's a Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As these concerns continue to spread about coronavirus, Democrats in the U.S. House are pushing for mandated paid sick leave. But, you know, long before the pandemic began, some activists and politicians right here in Texas were making the push at the local level. In fact, you may recall three major Texas cities took steps to do just that. But all three now face challenges in the courts. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony has more.
San Antonio, Dallas, and Austin recently passed paid sick time ordinances. But in San Antonio and Austin, those policies are tied up in court, and Dallas could face an injunction before the city starts enforcing its ordinance in April. With coronavirus spreading, many advocates say those policies are more critical now than ever before.
Look at how rapidly it's spreading.
State Senator Royce West represents Dallas.
What I will say is, without the ability to have paid sick time, that you're going to have a lot of people without the necessary resources in order to pay their rent, to take care of child care, to take care of issues concerning health care. So a whole host of issues. We need to make certain that there is a safety net.
But many small businesses say that mandatory paid sick time would cause economic harm. Annie Spillman is the Texas State Director and lobbyist for the National Federation of Independent Business.
Businesses in general are not in favor of any sort of government mandate, but specifically one that mandates their benefits packages.
According to a research survey by the nonpartisan group Trust for America's Health, about 68% of Texan workers do have paid time off. But that other 32%, more than 4 million people, are among the most vulnerable. Many work in the service industry and live paycheck to paycheck. Spillman says the service industry often allows workers to swap shifts.
99.9% of the time, if they have to miss a shift because they're sick, that employer will let them make up another shift at another time, and they'll be able to make up that money.
But at restaurants that don't offer paid sick time, workers who can't find someone to pick up their shift are often expected to work, even when they're sick.
I was not sick with something that was contagious, but even if I was, he still, you know, my manager still would have expected me to be there.
Emily Burns was fired after she didn't show up for work at a San Antonio restaurant. She was hospitalized for a debilitating medical condition that her doctor now thinks is endometriosis.
I don't see how business owners and places can just expect you to just not put food on the table for yourself because you aren't feeling well. It's kind of like being punished for being sick. You're sick, okay, you don't get paid. Now we're going to make it even harder for you. You can't provide for your family. You can't provide for yourself.
Some small businesses in the service industry do already offer paid sick time. William Gaskins owns Tabletop Generals, a gaming tavern in San Antonio.
And I'm a very small business. A big complaint is from these large companies. So, well, we can't afford to offer paid time off. And I said, well, if I can, with my, you know, my minimal profits and my, you know, daily small business struggles, and I can somehow manage to do it, I'm sure that your huge multi-million or billion-dollar company can also do it.
Before starting Tabletop Generals, Gaskins worked as a server on the San Antonio Riverwalk, a hub of international tourism.
During a night shift, a busy one, I would interact with 400 people easily from all over the world sometimes, you know. If I was sick, that's 400 potential transmissions.
And most of all, if you are sick or not feeling well, stay home.
President Donald Trump addressed the nation on Wednesday and hinted at some type of relief for people who miss work while sick. But details were sparse.
This will be targeted for workers who are ill, quarantined, or caring for others due to coronavirus.
Congressional Democrats' efforts to mandate paid sick time are currently blocked by Senate Republicans. President Trump also promised that insurance copayments for any coronavirus-related treatment will be waived. But the insurance industry quickly said only testing costs will be waived. And questions remain for uninsured people, including more than 5 million in Texas, who usually have to cover medical tests and treatment on their own. For uninsured people without paid sick leave, that's another expense that has to be covered by working. I'm Dominic Anthony in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As you likely have heard by now, most Texas colleges and universities extended spring break to give staff and faculty time to set up online coursework, just one of the many ways schools are trying to reduce possible spread of the coronavirus among students. At the same time, schools across the state are reminding their communities to avoid travel to countries considered high risk for the coronavirus by the CDC. However, for now, Mexico's not on that list, even though Cancun and other beach resorts are popular destinations this time of year, spring break and all. But on the border, some students travel back and forth from Texas to Mexico on a daily basis. KTEP's Angela Cocherga talked to students at the University of Texas at El Paso about how the virus is affecting their routines.
On the University of Texas at El Paso campus, on a day with the temperature hovering near 70, Quentin Rodriguez was reading a book outside and looking forward to spring break.
Going down to San Marcos with a couple of friends of mine.
And any concerns about travel because of the coronavirus or the COVID-19?
Yeah, I got some of my friends telling me to stay out of San Antonio.
Rodriguez said other friends had a trip planned to the biggest spring break destination, Cancun.
But they're still a little worried that it's a lot of people going over there, you know?
Are they going to go after all?
Oh, yeah, they are.
He said those students were more concerned about losing their deposit if they canceled the trip than catching the coronavirus in Mexico. That country had 13 confirmed cases as of Thursday evening, far fewer than the U.S. On the border, Mexico is more than a vacation spot for students like Heriberto Perez Jr. It's home.
There's no serious case right here, so I'm relaxed about that thing, about leaving the Juarez and crossing every day. So it's not a problem for me right now. I'm not thinking about it at all.
Hundreds of students from Mexico cross the border daily to attend universities and colleges in Texas. At least 650 at UTEP alone have addresses in Juarez, according to the university, although the number of commuters is probably much higher. Others, like Sofia Portugal, live in El Paso but go back and forth to Juarez on a regular basis.
I visit my grandparents, both of them, every week, so I go at least twice a week.
President Trump said he was contemplating closing the border with Mexico, but now says that is not under consideration. Portugal's biggest concern with coronavirus is not the border, but classmates who do not wash their hands enough.
Honestly, I don't think we're taking it that serious, and I feel like we should, especially like college students. Because, yeah, we're here all day and we get gross and we don't do anything about it.
In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocheriga.
You know, for decades, Houston's Windsor Village United Methodist Church was a frequent stop for presidents and first ladies coming to Texas, thanks to its charismatic pastor, Kirby John Caldwell. But this week in a federal court, Caldwell pleaded guilty to wire fraud. The Houston Chronicle reporting Reverend Caldwell admitted to being part of a scheme to convince members of his congregation to buy bogus bonds. Court documents say he used the money to pay off personal debts and maintain his lifestyle. Caldwell was spiritual advisor to Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Sentencing is set for July 22nd. We'll keep you posted. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. At the Texas Roundup next.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The spread of coronavirus has reached central Texas with the first presumptive positive cases confirmed in Austin. Local officials announced this morning two people independently contracted the illness from outside the area. Austin's interim medical authority, Mark Escott, says the virus will likely spread in the community and residents must respond wisely.
One path is to choose fear and panic. The other path is to choose strength and resiliency. We have to choose strength. And that means we need people to start planning. We need them to do things which are reasonable to mitigate this risk.
Last night, Dallas's mayor declared a state of emergency and Dallas County banned large public gatherings until March 20th. Governor Greg Abbott will hold a news conference this afternoon about the state's response to the outbreak. Meanwhile, San Antonio is confirming its first travel-related case of COVID-19. It is not linked to the federal quarantine at Lackland Air Force Base. Also today in that city, University Hospital is beginning to screen and limit visitors to prevent the spread of coronavirus. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
During the SARS epidemic in Toronto, there were two waves of illness. UT Health San Antonio Dr. Jan Patterson is an expert in infectious diseases, and she volunteered to help in Toronto during that second wave. She told Texas Public Radio recently that it started with hospital visitors.
And what had happened is that visitors who were sick would come and visit people in the hospital and transmit it to people in the hospital.
Starting today, University Hospital will try to head off that type of infection occurring by limiting patient visitors to two a day, screening all visitors for symptoms, and barring those who've traveled to a high-risk area. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Invitations to participate in the 2020 census are arriving at homes in Texas and across the U.S. through March 20th. The national headcount will have long-term effects on Texas, says Katie Martin Lightfoot. She's with the Center for Public Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank in Austin. She explains the federal government uses census data to allocate money to states.
This is federal funding going into our healthcare system, our education, our community, our roads. And in Texas, if we have a 1% undercount in our state, a conservative estimate is that we will lose $300 million per year for the next 10 years.
Households can respond to the census online, by phone, or by mail. And the young man accused of fatally shooting 10 people at Santa Fe High School in 2018 will remain at a mental health facility for now. He's currently not competent to stand trial. The Houston Chronicle reports a judge issued the order Wednesday to keep the 19-year-old at a state hospital for at least 12 months. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. This week, the World Health Organization finally did something that some officials seem to be urging the global health body to do for some time. Go on ahead and declare that pandemic, which, given the spread of the coronavirus, might seem like some obvious move. But let's stop right here. Why the extended deliberation? What does pandemic actually signify? And as a practical matter, what does it mean? Rebecca Fisher is an assistant professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at Texas A&M University's School of Public Health. Dr. Fisher, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, now that the World Health Organization is using this term pandemic, what does that actually signify in a way that might be understandable to laypersons?
Well, for epidemiologists like myself, all over the world, we've been watching the situation, of course, very closely. And the very definition of a pandemic is a disease that has spread globally. So many of us have been using the word pandemic for some time, mm-hmm. but sort of sitting by and waiting for the governing body of the global health to make this declaration. Of course, they have different considerations to make, political, economic, and social impacts of such a declaration. So at this point, they have now signaled to local and national governments around the world that our containment strategy is not quite holding it back, but that there is still hope that we could turn this pandemic around.
Well, let me stop you right there, because you just used the term epidemic, and that's the way we've been talking about it. You know, you sort of want to lean into this pandemic descriptor, but I'm curious, why does that matter? Why would there be a political implication here?
The political implication, I think, really stems from countries being able to be prepared, prepare themselves locally for social and economic impacts, as well as challenges to their health infrastructure. A lot of countries are not resourced to handle this sort of thing. And so this is really sort of a political move by the WHO, and actually can incite sort of fear unnecessarily in individuals. So we know a pandemic declaration does not mean that the disease has changed. Mm-hmm. So it's not making more people sick. It's not becoming more deadly. It's simply an indication that it has spread to a level that, or to many countries, and then within many countries, it's now spreading locally.
So we now have a pandemic. Epidemic is right beneath that, and outbreak below that. Is there a fourth level, or is this it?
This is it. We're there.
It doesn't get any worse than this. It's pandemic now.
Yeah, and frankly, this is why the WHO takes so long to think and deliberate about this. You know, they have so much to consider when making this decision, and they were criticized widely for their declaration in the 2009 H1N1 pandemic for declaring it early. So, I mean, they can't win. Whatever they do, they can't win.
Okay, so does this, if I understand what you're saying then, this we're talking about, as you to use your term, continuum, we're talking about how far and wide this spread has become. But does it mean anything substantially different for, say, those of us here in the U.S.? Already officials seem to be taking steps. Once you start talking about it as a pandemic, does that change the range of steps or the range of actions that you can then take?
So we've already seen some restrictions and recommendations in terms of travel. So that would certainly be a pandemic response. Locally, to us in the United States, since we have seen spread and community spread within some of our states already, it really shouldn't change today what we're doing. And actually, what we should be doing is on a personal level, all of us as individuals, really strictly adhering to the hygiene recommendations and the self-isolation or social distancing, as they're telling us to do, because that's really what's going to have the biggest impact on change. So the authorities, of course, are responding to official declaration of pandemic in a way that affects sort of movement between countries.
Just to be clear, if at this point now we're talking about the pandemic, I suppose, of 2020, if in fact it turns out that the number of diagnosed cases begin to slow, does it then shift back, say, to epidemic or maybe even a lower level outbreak, or once a pandemic, always a pandemic?
Really, once a pandemic, always a pandemic. And this is really an historic event. This is a rare occurrence. It's really kind of a big deal and a landmark event sort of in infectious diseases history. So this will always be, from now until the end of time, the pandemic of COVID-19.
Rebecca Fisher is an assistant professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at Texas A&M University School of Public Health. Dr. Fisher, thanks so much for the clarification.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've been tracking plummeting oil prices. Few reasons for the drop, the coronavirus, of course, but perhaps a bigger factor, price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia. Back in mid-February, West Texas Intermediate was selling for over $50 a barrel. As of this morning, it's closer to $30. That $20 spread has a multi-billion-dollar ripple effect from Wall Street to West Texas. In fact, some drillers like Apache Corporation have already announced they're pulling out of the Permian Basin. Others rolling back operations, leaving locals where exactly? Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports.
At 1:30 a.m. on Monday, Griselda Rubio's phone rang. Her husband, a drilling rig operator, was calling from out in the field. He had bad news.
He was like, we need to get prepared. You know, the oil field just dropped, and I don't know if we're going to have a job or what's going to happen.
This, she says, was heartbreaking. Busts aren't something you forget around here.
I was like, oh no, not again.
She lives in Andrews, about an hour north of Odessa, and Rubio only has to worry about herself and her husband. Still, they have bills to pay.
We live day by day, and if we don't have a little savings, then you can't get through.
Oil makes and breaks the Permian Basin. The history here is filled with booms and busts. So when things are good, prices on pretty much everything shoot up. But locals can mostly keep up because salaries shoot up too. But when oil crashes, a lot of people are left in the dust.
If it doesn't come back from this, if it doesn't rebound, I'm going to have to sell the truck I just bought.
That's Clayton DeMint.
I'm going to have to take all the money out of my 401k just to be able to pay my rent. I mean, I'm going to have to find something else.
DeMint is 22 and came out to Odessa 3 years ago to work in the oil patch. He had just dropped out of college and was pretty much following in his father's footsteps. In the 80s, his dad worked out here until one of the region's worst busts left him unemployed. Decades later, it might be Clayton DeMint's turn. But he still has a job, for now.
It's been crazy. Everybody I've talked to, every single one of them is talking about what they're going to do when it eventually comes out and their company goes out of business.
There's no way for DeMint to tell when or if he's going to lose his job.
I'm nervous. I'm scared. I know people that got laid off Sunday, and I feel like there's going to be a whole lot more of that all over this area.
Oil industry analyst Reed Olmsted from IHS Market says, unfortunately, that's probably right. And if Olmsted ran into an oil worker at a bar,
I'd tell them that I'll buy their beers. What we see, look, there's no good story here. It's an unpleasant world that we live in. It's a boom and bust.
The analyst sees a lot of factors playing into this dramatic downturn. a barrel of West Texas Intermediate started the year around $60. This week, it's around $30. Olmsted's not officially calling this situation a bust yet, but he might be soon. IHS projects it could take as long as a year for oil prices to reach a more sustainable level of $40 to $50. And that means thousands in the Permian Basin will lose their jobs as oil drilling hits a wall.
You know, we're going to see activity come down by 50% out there in the second half of the year.
Some oil companies will go out of business. Others will get taken over by competitors. That, Olmsted says, could set up the Permian for one of the worst downturns in decades. The best advice he has for folks in the oil patch right now is to save their money and hunker down. But that's just not possible for everyone. I caught up with Jay Mercer smoking outside of a gas station, watching 18-wheelers drive by. Are you ready if this becomes a bust?
I mean, me particularly? No. No. I mean, you make so much money out here that you don't think that it's going to go away, you know? So when it happens like that, then boom. I mean, I'm not, no.
Mercer's a Marine veteran who served in Afghanistan. He really found himself coming to work in the Permian after leaving the service. The money he makes at an oil service company lets him dream about his future really for the first time in his life. If Mercer ends up getting laid off, then he'll head back to Louisiana to live off his veteran's disability check until he can find another job.
You know, when the prices go down, rigs are going to start stacking out, the people are going to start laying off. It's no good.
Mercer says the one thing the sudden fall of oil prices really shows is that tomorrow is never guaranteed, especially in the oil field. For the Texas Standard, I'm Mitch Borden in Odessa.
Amid the home front war on COVID-19, word late Thursday that the U.S. carried out airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia sites in Iraq, a reminder of an ongoing war on terrorism. Congress typically waits until 10 years after the end of a conflict to erect a memorial to it, but some say the time is now. For the American Homefront Project, Caitlin Kim has more.
It's no surprise that two veterans are spearheading this legislative push. Democrat Jason Crow of Colorado is a former Army Ranger who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Republican Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin was a Marine Corps intelligence officer who deployed to Iraq. Both their lives were changed and impacted by war. For Crow, the memorial is about those veterans having a place to call their own.
It's not about the politics or the policy of the war. It's about, you know, the service of millions of Americans who have stepped up to do what millions of Americans before us have done and millions will do in the future. And that's important to who we are as a country.
The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been America's longest wars, often called the Endless Wars, launched in 2001 and 2003, respectively, and still going today. Gallagher says the memorial is about recognizing a generation of veterans for their service and sacrifice.
We're not saying mission accomplished, nothing to see here. Indeed, the opposite. We're reminding, I think, everybody of the enormous cost of these wars.
Babies born just after 9/11 are some of the young men and women now fighting these wars. And when you add in how long it could take for a memorial to get approved and constructed, well, Crow sees no reason to delay.
I don't think it's right to wait until, you know, some of the veterans aren't around to see it.
Just as important to the two legislators is location, the National Mall. The mall is in the heart of the nation's capital and attracts millions of tourists a year for different reasons.
I mean, it's a place of remembrance.
It's like a great way to like represent all the people that have like had an impact on American history.
Our country, I mean, it's the United States, it's everybody's freedom.
That was Abigail Krieger from Denver, Caitlin Keeley from Washington, Illinois, and Michael Lawless from Savannah, Georgia. The challenge is the mall has limited space. There are 11 other new memorials being planned, including ones for Dwight Eisenhower, World War I, and Gold Star Mothers. There is a commission that advises the federal government on national memorials. And with an increasing number of war memorials being proposed, some ask if the mall is a space of collective national identity, isn't America more than just its wars? Army veteran Chris Yazel raised that question on a military blog.
If you look across the Potomac River at Arlington National Cemetery, and I think that's a pretty powerful memorial in and of itself.
Yazel does not object to a memorial being built, you know, sometime in the future. Standing at the top of the Lincoln Memorial, He says he'd like to see Congress more focused on helping current veterans, be it jobs, education, or health care.
Just be good Americans and do our part to leave a better society for future generations.
Michael Rodriguez, a retired Special Forces Green Beret and president of the Memorial Foundation Project, says it's something to think about.
Our nation's front line should depict American life. I agree with it.
But that's exactly why Rodriguez argues the men and women who defend American values should be recognized on the Mall.
You know, we're honoring those people to step up and defend and protect everything that we want to highlight. So to think that their contributions to our way of life is anything less, I don't really see the points on that.
Rodriguez is optimistic that the location bill can be passed and a design agreed to by 2024. Representatives Crow and Gallagher have over 45 co-sponsors for the bill, but time is running out in this congressional session. One thing most everyone agrees on, they hope the memorial process doesn't reflect the wars and become endless. In Washington, D.C., I'm Caitlin Kim.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans, with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, a destination for bird lovers, with Featherfest, guided tours, and exhibitions paying homage to the island's rich birding history, including the Lost Bird Project, opening in March. Galveston.com/lostbird.
I am Jody Edgerton, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And we are a group that crafts custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, an idea, a phrase, something you'd like a poem about, and we will write you a poem on the spot. I've got a poem for you about St. Patrick's Day. I do not like green eggs and ham, but I'll eat them today to celebrate an Irish saint who made snakes go away. I'm full of pride and festive joy, but missed it by an inch. I forgot to wear a bit of green, and I keep getting pinched. In truth, I'm feeling kind of low. It's getting pretty old. But hey, there goes a leprechaun! Aw yeah, here comes my gold. I'm Jody Edgerton, and you're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem, of course, comes to us from our friends at the Typewriter Rodeo. You know what to do. If you have an idea for a topic, let us know. Send your request through social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Now for a recap of the week that was in Texas, and what a week it was. We are joined by Alex Samuels. She is political reporter for the Texas Tribune, texastribune.org. Alex, welcome back.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me.
How are you holding out? Are you sequestered and staying safe?
Yes, of course. I just got back from the grocery store, and it's pretty crazy there, but right now, staying safe at home.
You got to get there early if you're going to pick up any toilet paper. Okay, so coronavirus obviously remaining our top story, not just here in Texas, but clearly around the world. What are you hearing from Texas lawmakers? Are they all on the same page?
So we're actually going to probably get an update from Governor Abbott around noon today. I think he'll talk a little bit more about the state's response to the coronavirus. Of course, the big thing that we're looking at now is testing, how much is available and how many Texans have actually received testing. The other big thing we're watching is what lawmakers are self-quarantining at this time.
Yeah, in fact, I understand that Ted Cruz has announced that he's extending his self-quarantine. In state politics, I want to shift gears for just a moment because we've been talking about the coronavirus quite a bit over the past hour, but there have been some announcements about who might fill an unexpected vacancy, that vacancy being that of Texas Senator Kirk Watson of Central Texas, right?
Right. So far, two candidates have entered the race to replace Kirk Watson. Eddie Rodriguez was the first state house lawmaker from Austin here. He launched his bid, I believe, last weekend. And then earlier this week, Travis County Judge Sarah Eckhart resigned from her position to run for the open seat.
Why is this such a big deal? I mean, this is, it is after all, a state senator's seat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so obviously senators represent a bigger population, represent a bigger part of Austin than a state House member. Vacancies are few and far between, and they serve longer terms than a House member. So it's, you know, a pretty big seat for anyone who has the opportunity to run for it.
Pretty big opportunity. And I suppose we should mention a couple of things on the presidential front. By presidential, I'm really talking about the presidential contest here come November. Michael Bloomberg, he pulled out of the running. But as I understand it, according to what I've been reading in the Texas Tribune, there are lots of former staff members here in Texas who are not at all happy. What happened?
Right. So when Bloomberg visited Texas about 9 or 10 weeks ago, he made a stop in East Austin. He said that Texas was a big battleground state and that he was going to keep staff on the ground to help flip the state, regardless of who the presidential nominee is, and to help Democrats down ballot. Fast forward to this week and earlier this week, all staff members, so about 150 Texas staffers, were told that they were being laid off and that they could apply for Bloomberg's new independent committee, which is helping Joe Biden, but essentially they were out of jobs. So a lot of staffers are upset, and a lot of House lawmakers are upset too, because they were hoping he would use his resources to help them in their, you know, attempt to flip the Texas House.
Boy, that's a juicy political story unto itself. Of course, you can keep up with all this news and a whole lot more over at texastribune.org. Alex Samuels is political reporter for the Texas Tribune, and she joins us every week about this time to get us caught up on the week that was in Texas politics. Alex, thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. He's back, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. That is Wells. I would imagine a lot of folks, unusual Friday for a lot of folks.
Yeah, not the normal Friday mm-hmm. vibes out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of concern out there. Obviously, the big story, coronavirus. Public schools in Houston and Austin, you know, they canceled all classes today in response to concerns, a move that's obviously impacting families in those cities.
Yeah.
This tweet from a listener is one example. Hello Pretty writes that the largest school district in Corpus Christi extended their spring break another week, a move that many districts are doing. They write that many parents are relieved, but based on comments on their Facebook page, others aren't, because they don't have childcare or they think they're overreacting. Luckily, I have a job with tons of flexibility. And yeah, we're going to see, I think, a lot more of that as these decisions are made over spring break starting next week for many school districts across the state. Randy Oman writes that I've sent local superintendents encouragement to lead by following best practices in light of what we know. Randy goes on to say that we should be closing and using distance learning. And obviously, that's the plan at many colleges and institutions of higher learning across the state.
In a way, this is the big test, and I know we'll be talking about this in years to come. This will be the first real big test for telecommuting. And this has been something that people have talked about. You know, could it be done on a large scale? We're about to find out in rather dramatic fashion, and people will be exploring that and its applications for years to come.
Yeah, real interesting ramifications. I saw there's been a big push for major telecom providers like AT&T to temporarily reduce like usage caps and speeds and boost speeds and things like that. So interesting stuff. Obviously, not just schools being impacted, large events being canceled. Some breaking news out of San Antonio. Dominic Anthony, I believe he's an intern at TPR, Texas Public Radio News in San Antonio. He attended a press conference today. He writes that after the city of San Antonio confirmed the first travel-related coronavirus case in the city, the Fiesta Commission announced Fiesta will be postponed for the first time since World War II.
Well,
Fiesta,
that's a big one. That's
a Fiesta, big one. That, I believe, a 17-day festival brings in north of $300 million, something in the range of you know, the economic impact of Austin's South by Southwest festival. Dominic tweets that Fiesta has apparently been pushed back to November. So still going forward, but obviously being pushed back due to these concerns. And we're going to, you know, so we'll learn more about that. We're also going to learn more about the state's response, other things, issues they may be monitoring. Governor Greg Abbott slated to give a press conference Friday afternoon. So obviously tons of developments that we're doing our best to watch, along with all of our public radio partners all across Texas, as this continues to impact everyone.
And of course, the news continues right here on this radio station. And you can keep up with what's happening statewide at texasstandard.org. Keep your comments coming, because we'd love to share them with our listeners, too. You just look for Texas Standard online, the social media platform of your choice. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. We're going to be back here on Monday, of course, and we hope you will join us. Till then, stay safe, keep those hands washed, keep them away from your face, and we wish you all the very best from Austin.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.